I guess I have to introduce myself because I'm the moderator today for all the sessions, all the men-only sessions. My name is Leibish Heller, and the topic we're going to discuss today is the need for a Rebbe. Ever since the inception, ever since the very beginning of the Hasidic movement, one of the most intriguing aspects of this movement was the Rebbe-Chassid relationship. And historians, theologians, psychologists, thinkers of all different denominations tried to analyze what is the nature of this relationship. In what way does it differ from the typical Rosh Yeshiva and his Talmud, the rabbi and his congregants, the teacher and his students? Because it was clear that there's a deeper dynamic taking place here. It wasn't common prior to the Baal Shem Tov that Jews should trod over miles, many, many miles, just to get a glimpse of their Rebbe. And that if somebody would come back from an experience with his rabbi and his face would be aglow, he'd be on a high for a couple of months. What happened? What was the impact? What took place in that interaction that so changed the life of the Chassid? It was clear to any observer that the Rebbe made a major contribution to the life of his Chassidim. But the question is, can we quantify this? Can we put our finger on it? Can we say that we can identify what the need for a Rebbe is all about? And this morning I will attempt to address this issue from a subjective point of view, from the perspective of a Chassid. And maybe during the course of this discussion we can have more of a dialogue as well, if you want to pose questions and raise issues, so we can take this back and forth.
Excuse me, can you
turn the volume? I'm not sure how to do this thing, but there's about seven dials here.
One out of seven is not bad.
Volume, yes, one says volume.
Ah.
To the left, I assume.
Right.
Is that better? Is it better now? Now it's off. Is it? I don't need it. If you can hear me, I'm fine. I don't need it. What? We're fine. Yes, okay. So let's take a look. Let's take a look at this week's Torah portion. We read the story of Joseph. At the time, the youngest of the 12 tribes, the 11th son of his father Jacob, the favorite son. He spends the first couple of years of his life in the environment of his father's home. He has his father's favorite attention. He studies under the guidance of his father. And suddenly, he's plucked out of that environment. His brothers mercilessly take him. They throw him into a pit. They sell him to the Midianites. Eventually, he makes his way down to Egypt. And Providence leads him to the house of Potiphar, one of the ministers in Pharaoh's government. A little boy in an alien foreign country, a place that's not very conducive to morality and ethics, not at all the type of environment that he was brought up in. In fact, our sages tell us that Egypt was the lowest of all elements, Erev HaSa'aretz. But Joseph maintains his standards. He maintains his loyalty to the ideals and teachings that he picked up in his house. He's dedicated to his master. He looks after his estate. The man trusts him 100%. He puts him on top of all of his affairs. And Joseph's managed to find a certain sense of peace with his situation. And then one day, he's approached by his master's wife. She attempts to seduce him. And this is not just some act of lust or folly, but she has this vision, this astrological, prophetic knowledge that this union has to happen. And she will do everything at her disposal to make it happen. And Joseph, of course, knows it's wrong, and he resists and resists and resists. Until one day, the pasuk says, "Vayovay abayso lasois malachtoi." He came home to do his business, and she was the only one in the house. And the simplistic reading of the text has us thinking that he came home to do the errands of the house. He's obviously not going to go to the house of idolatry, so he stays home. But our sages tell us, Joseph came home because he planned to succumb to her advances. A premeditated act. Wasn't on the spur of the moment. Some sort of a calculation. Maybe we'll never know why. But Joseph decided that he's going to do the act. Nothing, no powers of persuasion that he can come up with were strong enough to resist him from going ahead with it. It was an intellectual decision in this boy's mind that he's going to do it. That's what happens. And the Gemara tells us that at that moment, when they were about to embark on that cardinal sin, Joseph saw a vision. So the Gemara says there was nobody with him in the house. But in the window of the house, he saw something. He saw the complexion of his father's image. Says the Gemara. He saw the image of his father in the window. And that image had so powerful an impact on him that he dropped mid-action. At an advanced stage, he ran out of the house. He lost his equilibrium. He was lost. He was gone. He ran straight out of the house, as a result of which he spent 3 years in prison. He couldn't continue with that act in the presence of his father. And here's the question. What happened? What was there in that message? He saw a picture of his father. He saw an image of his father. But what could his father have communicated in those few seconds that would so drastically change him, metamorphosize him within a moment, from being someone who is apathetic, who couldn't care less, who's given in, to someone who stands up and puts his life at risk for his ideals and his beliefs? Now you might say that, well, Joseph's father stood for many important teachings and lessons, and Joseph may have forgotten them. And when he saw that image, it reminded him of the things his father had taught him. But we know it's not the case. We know that Joseph remembered everything he was taught. In fact, we see later on in the Chumash that prior to their first meeting, Joseph sends a message to Jacob telling him, "You should know that I remember everything you taught me." And anything that child needed to know, he was taught. So the information was already there. The knowledge was there. What happened at that moment that shattered him so strongly? I will attempt this morning to answer this question on two levels. Maybe we can explore the relationship between Joseph and Jacob, Yosef and Yaakov, Yaakov as a teacher, and Yaakov as a tzaddik, as a mystic. A Rebbe means two things. A Rebbe is a Rav. A Rebbe is someone who teaches his students. But a Rebbe is also more than a Rav. A Rebbe is someone who uplifts his students. On the first most basic level, Yaakov as a teacher wasn't the type of teacher you might find in an environment like this. In a typical school of any nature, any type of school. The Gemara says, the Gemara gives a definition. What is a teacher? The Gemara says, you want to have a teacher, you want to go out there and study Torah from someone, how can you determine whether or not the person is suitable to teach you Torah? So the Gemara says the following. Check him out. Look at his face. If his face is similar to that of an angel of God, seek Torah from his mouth. And if that's not the case, do not study Torah from that person. You should learn from him. And if not, don't. That's what the Gemara says. And that's a very strange statement. You want to know what a good teacher is? I'll tell you what a good teacher is. First of all, a good teacher has got to be very articulate, very knowledgeable and very learned, very clear, very devoted. Maybe he's got to be dynamic, charismatic. Doesn't have to look like an angel. In fact, it doesn't matter what a teacher looks like. You don't learn from the teacher's looks. So this is not a modeling school. talking about learning knowledge. Why is it so important how the teacher looks? And if it is important, why like an angel? My friends, what is the definition of an angel? In what way is an angel different to a human being? An angel is a messenger of God's. When the angel is on that mission, to do a specific message, mission, to perform something on behalf of the divine. Let's say, for example, the angel that was out to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. It wasn't some sort of separate entity with a mind and heart of its own that happens to take on this particular mission. If you send a human being on a mission, the mission doesn't encompass every aspect of that human being at that moment. The human being has his own worries and concerns, his own passions and drives, his own scars and issues. At this particular venture, he's doing what you want him to do for you. But that doesn't make up the sum total of that person. An angel is one thing, a messenger of God. There's nothing but the fulfillment of that message. So much so that the angel that's out to turn over Sodom and Gomorrah can't even communicate to Sarah that she's going to have a child. Because in his mind is one thing, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Nothing else exists. And the other angel has one mission and only one mission, to convey to Sarah that she'll be her child. And the third angel to save Lot and his family. An angel is entirely dedicated to their message. They live the message. They personify the message. It's not like the typical teacher who stands there, does one thing and says something else. They say about Aristotle that they once saw him behaving in a very unethical way, and he said to them, listen, there's Aristotle at the pulpit, and there's Aristotle who's out in the fields. He wouldn't qualify as a teacher. According to this quotation from the Gemara, you shouldn't appoint Aristotle as your teacher. Doesn't compare. He doesn't live up to an angel of God. Certainly, he can be someone that communicates knowledge, but not a teacher. Not a teacher that can change your life. Not a teacher whose image in the window will metamorphosize you in one moment. I'll back up.
You know, you can't.
I can't?
No, it's not in your nature.
Okay. Thank you, sir. So that's the story of an angel. They say a story about Rabbi Lev Yitzchak of Berdichev. Rabbi Lev Yitzchak of Berdichev was a young man, a genius. He was married back in the day. They got married at a very young age, maybe 15 or 16 he was married. And the custom was that for the first couple of years, the groom would be supported by the father-in-law until he became financially independent. So here he was living in the home of his father-in-law. And he turns to his father-in-law one day and says, listen, I need to travel to Mizrich. I have this urge to visit the Maggid of Mizrich. This new age rabbi, the successor of the Baal Shem Tov, there's something there that he has to offer that I cannot get elsewhere. And his father-in-law says, what's going on? We have local rabbis. We have great learned men. You don't have to travel hundreds of miles. And Rabbi Lev Yitzchak says, please, please, I want to go. And his father says, you know what, we'll make a deal. I'll give you 3 months. It's a 3-week journey each way. You spend 6 weeks there. But when you come back, I want to see that it's justified, that it was worthwhile, that it made sense. It wasn't just some waste of time. And sure enough, Rabbi Lev Yitzchak goes. And he comes back. And it's evident from his face that he's become a different person. He's been in the environment of the Maggid of Mizrich. But his father-in-law was still skeptical, and he says, tell me, what did you learn there? What did you discover there that you couldn't have learned here? So Rabbi Lev Yitzchak says, you know what I learned? I learned in Mizrich that there is a God. That there is a God. And his father says, Lev Yitzchak, come on, what's going on? You learned that there's a God? You had to trot for 6 weeks to learn that there's a God? And he calls in the maidservant, a 12-year-old ignorant girl, and he says, tell me, is there a God? And she says, of course there's a God. We've had monotheism for 3,000 years now. right? The pagans, they're the latecomers. But we know this God. So the Rebbe Yitzchak said, she says it. I know it. She says it. I live it. For her, it's some sort of a theory. For me, it's a reality. It's my being. It's permeated every aspect of myself. Joseph was sitting in the house of Potiphar. He was about to sin. He saw his Rebbe. He saw in his Rebbe the ultimate teacher. All the truths that he had learned, that he knew as theories, became real because he saw the personification of those messages. Take a simple message. We all know that. We've known it ever since we were 2 years old. Do we live it? Do we believe that this is an inheritance? The Torah is commanded to us by Moses. It's an inheritance for all of the congregation of Jacob. That you and I have equal access to the Torah. That every element in the Torah is meant to be a directive, a sign, guidance in our lives. When we're in trouble, do we turn to the Torah? Is that our first port of call? Do we cherish this as the ultimate gift, as our most precious possession? Probably not. But imagine if you had a teacher when he said, said those very same words, but when those words came out of that mouth, you saw it's real. You saw Torah. It's alive. It's being personified at this moment. I see it in front of me. I see a teacher who lives it. Who's one with Torah. When he quotes Torah, this is my life. It's not just a quotation from an old text. Take another common text that we're all familiar with. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Who doesn't know that one? We know it. God is one. God of Israel is one. God of Israel is one. There is no other God. But wouldn't it be the case that if the God of Israel is really one, and oneness means all-encompassing, it encompasses every aspect of my life, every interaction, every transaction, every circumstance that I face is part and parcel of this oneness of God. Wouldn't it change the way I live my life? Wouldn't it make me a different person? So we don't know what Joseph saw in the eyes of his teacher. But all the teachings that he knew, all the teachings that he was able to repeat and lecture on and write academic papers about, weren't strong enough to protect him at that moment. But when he saw them in the image of his father, when he saw them alive in his teacher, in his Rebbe, it took on a different level. It took on a totally different dynamic. At that moment, it influenced him. He wasn't able to remain apathetic. But I think, my friends, I think it would be unfair to limit this whole concept of a Rebbe to just an ideal version of a teacher. Imagine if I had a teacher. Imagine if we had a teacher, the ideal teacher. A teacher lives their teachings. The likelihood is that Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Bardichev could have heard anything that he would hear him as rich, he could have heard it local in his own hometown. That's probably the case. But it wouldn't have been alive. It wouldn't have had that power to influence you, to penetrate the essence, the being, the to become part of your vitality, part of your life. But notwithstanding this, a teacher is not the be-all and end-all of what a Rebbe is. There's a letter that the Rebbe wrote 56 years, 5 months and 16 days ago. If you calculate it, it works out to Gimel Tammuz Tov Shin Yud. Just 1 second. Where is she? And Gimel Tammuz, over the last decade, was a very significant day associated to a Rebbe. But you check it up, this is a book that was printed way before then. And on Gimel Tammuz, the Rebbe sat in his office, and the Rebbe wrote a paper addressed to Chassidim. And in this paper, he discusses what is a Rebbe. That's the topic of his discussion on Gimel Tammuz. And the Rebbe quotes many different virtues that people attribute to a Rebbe. A Talmudic genius, a Goyin, a Baal Midas, a Baal Moifes. Somebody that has supernatural powers. Ever since the beginning of Hasidism with the Baal Shem Tov, that went hand in hand with what a Rebbe was. People turned to a Rebbe not just for spiritual guidance, but even for situations where the doctor couldn't help you, or your financial advisor couldn't help you. You went to a Rebbe. What the Rebbe says, none of these things actually encapsulate what a Rebbe is all about. That's not what a Rebbe is all about. By way of analogy, and the Rebbe doesn't use this analogy, but imagine somebody, a nomadic, primitive creature, a guy who grew up in a jungle, and he made a lot of money somehow, he found some treasure in the forest, he comes into an inhabited, civilized town, and he says to the first guy he meets, he says, tell me, what can I buy for $2 million? The guy says, for $2 million, you can get yourself a private plane. $2 million, you can get yourself a private plane. So he says, order me one right now. I'll give you a commission 10%. And sure enough, within a couple of hours, there's a private plane landing right in front of where this guy was situated on a public bench in the park. There is the plane sitting right in front of him, and he goes into the plane, he goes up the stairs, and he's amazed. He's amazed. It's wonderful. The chairs swivel around, they go back, you can lie down, you can move forward. There's even a special entertainment media thing there. You can watch one movie after the next for 100 years straight. There's a bar, you can have any drink, any cocktail you like. It's wonderful. This is amazing. I grew up in the forest, I never had anything like this. And he enjoys it. Spends hours in that plane. It's protecting him from the environment. Everybody out there is cold. He's protected, he's warm. There's weather control. And he's toying with his plane for a couple of days. And somebody tells him, sir, you know what a plane is? You know what the function of a plane is? A plane is not something where you just have a good time. A plane is meant to take you to the sky. A plane gives you access to things that you couldn't otherwise access. A plane takes you to heights that are naturally unreachable by a human being. That's what a plane is. You're getting carried away with the movies on the plane. That's not what a plane is all about. Get yourself a pilot and go up to the clouds. Explore the world. So the Rebbe says, you want to discuss what a Rebbe is? These things are true. Of course they're true. A Talmudic genius, for sure. For sure. A Baal Midos, absolutely. Baal Mesiras Nefesh, no question. And all of these things take on deeper dimensions when you understand them from the perspective of Hasidus and so on. What they mean from a mystical point of view. But that's not what a Rebbe is. That is not, that doesn't personify what a Rebbe is. A Rebbe is someone who takes you to places that you couldn't otherwise get to. A Rebbe is someone who takes you out of that which is naturally reachable by a human being. Takes you beyond. Takes you to heights that would otherwise be inaccessible. Now, this is obviously a nice thing to quote, and it sounds good as a theory, but can we quantify? Is this the case? Can we demonstrate that? If you want to see if a plane takes you to the sky, you get the pilot in and it takes you up to the clouds and you know you're there. Where and when do we see in the life of a chassid that the Chassid, thanks to his relationship to his Rebbe, reaches heights that he would otherwise not be able to attain. So I want to share with you, very briefly, an insight that the Rebbe says in connection to this very special day of Yutes Kislev. The Rebbe quotes a saying by a previous Rebbe, in which he describes a human being and his struggles as somebody who is digging beneath the surface. Because one of the basic Hasidic teachings is that as Jews, our mission in life and our goals as human beings is not to attain something external, to acquire some sort of a new identity from outside of ourselves. It's all about a process of uncovering and discovering, bringing forth that which is already inherently present within us. So the very first chapter in the Tanya, the magnum opus of the Hasidic world, tells us that deep within your soul, there are infinite resources. There's unity with God. There's oneness with God. There's a love for God. There's a fear and awe of God. There's a dedication and a commitment to be steadfast in everything Jewish. That's already there as part of the Jewish makeup, the DNA of every Jew. So it's all about digging away the outer layers and bringing that forth. So in this previous Hasidic text, there's a discussion of two types of excavations. One is somebody who is a coal digger. He digs in the earth to find and to bring forth coals. Coal is a commodity. People needed coals. Back in the day, you wanted to have a warm house. You wanted light. You needed coals. Otherwise, your family gets sick. Have a coal, like I did. You need coals. If you didn't have coals, you're not going to make it through the winter. But then, there are others that are on a mission to excavate not coals, but pearls. Pearls. Pearls are a luxury. Pearls are not a necessity. But nonetheless, it's a good business. The pearl business is a good business. So people go out there and they go deep sea diving to the very deck of the oceans to take out pearls. Not cultural pearls, natural pearls. They're in the bottom of the ocean. So you have these two people. One is digging into the earth to get coals. Another is digging into the ocean to get pearls. Both of them need direction and guidance. God forbid if you make the wrong move when you're digging for coals. A boulder can fall on your head. You know, you won't come out alive. So you need direction from someone who studied the map perfectly and knows what to do. And direction is not enough. If you're not going to follow your directions to precision, you're not going to make it. So that's the coal digger. And the same is true with the miner, the guy that's seeking out pearls from the bottom of the ocean. So the Rebbe says like this. A Jew is someone who digs into his soul, digs through his outer layers to discover those capacities that produce warmth, produce light, the coals, as well as the pearls. But what is the difference between the coals and the pearls? If you want the basic necessities, if you want the coals, says the Rebbe, it's enough to dig on dry land. But if you want pearls, if you want that luxury, you have to go into the ocean. Now what's the difference between the ocean and dry land? You get wet, okay, that's one thing. In England, you can get wet on dry land too. Unless you have... So here's the question, what's the difference? What is the difference between dry land and the ocean? So again, this is very basic Hasidic thinking. It goes back all the way to the earliest Hasidic texts that the difference between the ocean and dry land is that the ocean is a reality in which all of existence is consumed by the bigger picture. The creatures trotting on dry land are independent beings. The elephant, the lion, the human, they all think that they are there in their own right. There is no clear connection to their source of life. They exist independent of each other and independent of anything larger than themselves. However, all the creatures of the ocean, by definition, are dependent on the fact that they are present in that environment. If they should leave that environment, they cease to exist. They won't survive. So these are two realities that a human being can attain. We can live on one level of reality in which we see ourselves as independent creatures. We move around and we trot in dry land as independent beings. We're committed to an ideal, we're dedicated to what we're meant to be doing, but we see ourselves as separate entities. There's another level of reality in which we are consumed by a bigger picture. Where it's not about me, but it's about something greater than myself. There's the ocean. Part of the ocean is that it has a sea lion, and it has a whale, and it has a starfish, and so on. But it's all part of that bigger picture, the ocean. And the greatest height that a human being can attain, contrary to common belief, you know, there's this notion today that a sense of individuality is important. It's important for a person to have an individual identity. And that's true. That's true on a certain level. But Chassidus teaches that the ultimate achievement of a human being would be to transcend that identity, to go beyond. So the Rebbe says, if you want that luxury, if you want that deeper connection, if you want the pearls, you need to be willing to relinquish, to let go, to go into the ocean, to be consumed by the bigger picture, to be so overtaken by your Judaism, so overtaken by your dedication to God, to Torah, to what it means to be a Jew, that you lose your identity. And at that moment, you reach the essence of your soul. You discover the pearls within. My friends, I want to suggest that perhaps when Joseph saw that vision of his father in the window, it wasn't only the vision of a teacher. Joseph didn't only see his teacher. He didn't only see his father in the window. You know what Joseph saw at that moment? Joseph saw himself in the presence of his teacher. Joseph saw a different Joseph. When Joseph is face to face with Jacob, he takes on a different identity. The essence of his soul emerges. The core of his being. It's not about being more clever, having more knowledge, deeper appreciations of teachings he's been taught in the past. The essence of the soul comes forth and everything becomes clear. There's no more gray. There's black and white. I don't belong here. I am one with God. I belong to a deeper reality. I'm not an entity to myself. I'm not some independent creature trotting around this globe. Me and God are one. Joseph saw Joseph the way a chassid sees himself in the presence of his Rebbe. The yachid that emerges within the element of yechidus. When Yaakov appears in the window, Joseph becomes a different person. It's not the same person with a better teacher. It's not someone who can communicate messages that he personifies and lives up to, rather than just adjacent theories. The chassid becomes a different person. There's a mystical connection, a connection of the soul that brings forth the deepest elements of the human soul, the essence. The Yechido Shebenefesh. There was no room for calculations. There was no room for rationalizations. Everything becomes clear at that moment. And I believe that this is one of the reasons why the various different analysts that try to examine this relationship have been left mystified. They've never really managed to articulate what goes on there between a chassid and a rebbe. Because this is not something that can be analyzed on a phenomenological level. This is an existential reality that either one experiences or one doesn't. I just want to finish with a story. A story I heard recently about a Jew who lived somewhere in Western America. And this was a Jew who was an atheist. An atheist. Never believed in God. In fact, he would scoff. He would scoff at people that are religiously inclined. He was a very intellectual guy, a very sophisticated guy. He had respect for, you know, a 3,000-year tradition. But he had his own rational way of thinking, and to him it was obvious that there just was no God. It was beyond question. Now, here was a guy who, his wife suddenly began to show an interest in Judaism. And I'm talking practical Judaism. And this wasn't at all to his liking, but for the sake of the peace of the home, he went along with it. To cut a long story short, one day, this guy's daughter fell very ill. And the wife turned to the Chabad shliach of his town, of her town. And she said to him, our daughter is very ill and the doctors basically have given up hope. What can we do? So the shliach said, I can only tell you what I would tell myself. If I was in that situation, I would pick myself up now and I would take the next plane and I would go, this was after Gimel Tammuz, and I would go to the Rebbe's gravesite and I would pray and pray and pray and cry my heart out, and that's what I would do. So she said, okay, I have to do the same. The problem is, I have four children at home, I can't leave them. So the shliach says, how about your husband? She said, you're crazy, my husband's an atheist, he never prayed in his life. Well, maybe now his daughter's on the line, maybe he'll come and pray. So sure enough, the wife, as a wife can, she nags her husband enough, and he says, okay, I'll go and do it. And now the shliach is sitting next to this Jew, and they're flying to the oil. And on the plane, the shliach says to the Jew, how about putting on tefillin? He says, Rabbi,
those sessions are due to finish in 4 minutes after 1 o'clock. Thank you.
It's 1 o'clock on my watch now. You'll tell me when it's 4 minutes. The guy says, look, my wife is one thing, but you're not going to start nagging me, and I'm not putting on tefillin for nothing. They arrive at the oil, and this rabbi is now very weary of this guy. They're standing at the oil. Incidentally, the Tzemach Tzedek writes that when a chosid comes to the resting place of his Rebbe, that is the equivalent of yichidus, of that powerful interaction between a chosid and a Rebbe. We find this in various different sources, going all the way back to the spies, and in this week's and last week's portion with the matriarch Rachel, she was kept on the wayside so that the children of Israel should be able to pray at her gravesite. But in any case, they arrive at that resting place of the Rebbe, and the shliach goes into one corner, and this other guy's in the other corner, and the shliach sees from a distance that this guy is praying quite sincerely. This atheist is really praying. They come out. And the shliach was going to spend a couple of days in New York, and this guy was going to take the flight straight back from JFK to his hometown. This guy goes to the airport, and a couple of hours later, the shliach gets a phone call from the woman in Kentucky, wherever it was, and she says, Rabbi, I have bad news for you. Our daughter just died. And this guy says, oh my God. I told him to come down from Kentucky to New York to pray. This guy is an atheist. What's he going to do to me when I come back home? I can't go to that funeral. This guy will bombard me. So he says, forget it. I'm not going to the funeral. Maybe to the Shiva. I'll come to the last day when things are a little less hectic. And that's what happens. He comes in very reluctantly to the Shiva on the last day. He sits in the back of the room. And he's afraid, please, he says a silent prayer, please God, take this guy's attention elsewhere, because I don't have the answers. When someone's in that type of situation, there are no answers. But here he was, for the first time in his life, he was praying. Why did his daughter die? An innocent little child. There are so many questions. And the man turns his head and he says, Rabbi, I have a question for you. Can you come this way? And with melting knees, he moves forwards, and he sits down face to face, and the guy looks into his eyes. And I said, I want to finish with this story, and I leave it for you to contemplate about the message of the story. He says to him, Rabbi, I have a question. I've been an atheist my entire life. This wasn't some stubborn, Jewish, mentioned I arrived because I was angry at my mom or at my teacher in Cheder. I knew what I'm talking about. I have books that I authored on this subject. My question to you, Rabbi, and it's the first time I had a question of this nature. How come when I stood there at the oil, I believed in God? I believed in God. Where did it come from? I believed in God. My friends, I wish you a very good day. Thank you very much for listening.